Well, good afternoon. 2019, can you believe it? This is Pat Smits, and of course the program, It's the Law. And let's look at the weather today. They are talking about some hazardous weather conditions, although that does seem at least a little strange, but maybe because of the rain that's predicted for tonight. We have a 40% chance of rain, and then about a 90% chance of heavy rain and some areas of fog by tomorrow, Saturday. 100% heavy rain predicted, high of about 44 degrees. I'm wanting to be sure that this is actually the weather for this week, because we have been, you know, it's interesting because it doesn't say that it's today, but this is the weather that I was able to bring up. Sounds like it's the same weather that we were talking about back in December. But in any event, heavy rain and areas of fog tomorrow. Chance of rain and then partly cloudy on Saturday night. By Sunday, we should have mostly sunny, highs about 45 degrees. And then Monday, partly sunny, high of about 39 degrees. But the temperature is going to be up, which is going to be interesting. Even, for example, the Chicago area is going to be possibly in the 40s for the game, which everybody's going to be interested in from this area, at least all you Eagle fans and some of us from the Midwest, and, of course, the Bear fans. So we'll talk more, of course, about the football in the program. It's the sports guys, and right now it's the law. So we'll be talking about some of the legal issues, and I hope to have a guest today who's going to be talking about bankruptcy law, and especially bankruptcy law for the elderly or older folks. So we'll be back right after talking about some information from some of our sponsors.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hunter and Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know.
On Thursday, November 8th, from 2 till 7 p.m., the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce will be holding its 30th annual Business Expo.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you in business? Not a member of the chamber? Come to the Hunter and County Chamber Expo to see what it's all about and meet other business owners. Enjoy the restaurant showcase and enter to win the door prize just for business entries. The chamber offers special benefits for new memberships during the expo.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi and Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Well, I can't win with these spots. I guess I have an old list because, first of all, two of them were talking about the expo, which, of course, has been over for a couple months. And as far as Ameriprise, they're still sponsors, but they need to update their address. So those are, play one more, and then we'll talk a little bit more about some legal issues. Of course, it's been fairly quiet, but not totally quiet.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Okay, I'm Pat Smits. I'm the host of It's the Law. For those of you who know me, know I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County. But my practice is limited to family law matters, including more recently guardianship issues, and unfortunately some of our elderly need that. And we have a great surrogate here, by the way. I don't think anybody ever even goes and tries to run against Susan Hoffman. She's been, again, she's our been elected, and I don't even know how many times, but if you ever have any questions about estates or wills or anything to do with that area of law, she's the first go-to person. She is working for the county, and she handles all of the issues related to estates. And one of the things that people really need to know is that it's very foolish in New Jersey not to have a will, because it's so easy in New Jersey, if someone has a will, a valid will, I always suggest that it's signed by three people, three witnesses, because that makes it self-proving, and it is very easy, and not easy if it has to be probated, because with a probated will, people have to, if there is no will, if someone dies intestate, the person who is the administrator or administratrix needs to, in most cases and possibly all cases, needs to pay for a bond, etc. But in any event, getting back to what's happening, there was a one of the state judges has approved a $2 million class action settlement against an upscale golf club. And this was filed by former members who claimed they were stiffed on refunds when they resigned from the club. I don't know which club it was, but I'm sure that this was one of the ones that we would recognize. If and if I find out the name, I'll certainly let people know if anyone is interested. This was settled, though, so there is no written decision. There was a surgical center in Saddlebrook. They handled outpatient surgery, and their lawsuits are just multiplying by the thousands. Well, no, lawsuits are multiplying after thousands of its former patients were instructed to undergo testing for HIV and hepatitis that they could have contracted as a result of surgery at the center. I mean, two very serious illnesses, and no one wants, no one wants any illness, but certainly this is a these are pretty major. So what else? Not much has been happening this week as far as cases. There was a federal district court in New Jersey that ruled that an insurance company had no obligation to cover damage to a salon resulting from a thunderstorm in Princeton that dropped between 5 and 7 inches of rain in 2 hours. So they did not have to cover the damage, the rain damage. Interestingly, I don't know what type of insurance, but obviously that was something that you need to check your policy. But the amount of rain obviously was more than unusual to have that much rain in such a short time. And I don't know if flood insurance would have handled that. In any event, we all need to check our insurance policies, and most of us don't read them because they're so complicated. But it is interesting what they will and will not cover. For example, I recently had damage, and the insurance company covered some of it, but others, they said, was a matter that would be covered or should have been handled in maintenance. But there was no way that could have found out that there was any need for maintenance until we had the damage. In any event, it's important to read insurance policies. There's been a new dean, co-dean at the law school, at Rutgers University Law School, tapped a woman for the first time as vice dean and professor. She is a vice dean and professor, and she's now the co-dean. That's interesting. Say that quickly. Codeine sounds like the medicine, right? She's co/dean of the for the Camden Law School campus. Camden and Newark merged, and so they have co/deans now, one at Newark and one in Camden. And so she is not only the first woman, but she's the first African-American and the first member of the LGBT community to hold a dean position at the law school. So very, very significant. I mean, I think, you know, we certainly know how significant it is for Nancy Pelosi to be back in her position in Congress. Of course, this is a position that she held before, which is even more remarkable. I think the only Speaker of the House that was actually elected after not being elected for a long period of time was back maybe Sam Rayburn. But that's, you know, that's history, and I might even have it wrong. So apparently there's some law firm mergers in 2018. That was an exceptional year in law firm mergers and one of the busiest years because many, many firms are increasing in size, not at all unusual, but certainly much more so now than in the past. And yet the majority of attorneys in New Jersey are either solo practitioners or in very small firms. So there was a, I always like to talk about cases that are approved for publication, of course, and there was one family law civil procedure case that was approved this week, and this was written, the opinion in the appellate division was written by Judge Koblix, excellent judge. He was an excellent trial judge. He's been on the appellate division for a number of years, and in this case, the initials JG versus JH indicate that the court kept this confidential for a reason. Usually that involves issues involving children. So in this case, the plaintiff mother appealed from the trial court's custody and parenting time order entered after the trial court denied discovery, precluded the mother's lawyer from participating in the proceedings, and did not afford the opportunity for cross-examination or to call other witnesses. So that's pretty significant. So after the parties separated, they were initially granted joint legal custody of their son. And then after they subsequently attempted to reconcile. And during that time, the party's son lived with the mother, and the parties agreed to a flexible shared parenting time schedule. So the parties' relationship, as I said, they initially agreed to joint legal custody. Then they attempted to subsequently attempted to reconcile. And then when their relationship deteriorated and the mother pursued a new relationship, the defendant father alleged that the mother left their son in the care of her fiancé, and the father said that the fiancé was a, quote, well-known drug user and a convicted felon with multiple prison sentences. So then the father applied for sole custody, alleging drug usage and threatening behavior by the mother and her fiancé. The trial court at that point granted the defendant father temporary sole physical custody pending resolution of his application, but also provided the plaintiff mother with supervised parenting time. Now, after the trial, the court denied the mother's, at that point, mother's counsel. There was a motion to place the matter on a complex track to enable discovery. The court ordered joint legal and physical custody with defendant having primary residential custody. So this is what happened at the trial. So for some reason after, it wasn't after the trial the judge ordered this. It was after the trial court denied plaintiff's counsel's motion to place the matter on the complex track to enable discovery. It ordered legal and physical custody, physical custody with the defendant and joint legal custody, and the defendant having primary residential custody. So on appeal, the appellate division reversed the trial court's order and remanded for a plenary hearing. So at that point, the court first noted that the party should have been sent to mediation. And then the court further ruled that the trial court was in error in denying, without explanation, the plaintiff's counsel's request to place the matter on the complex track and to permit discovery. The appellate division ruled that the trial court was obligated to hold a plenary hearing where the parties made materially conflicting representations of fact concerning the danger that the mother and or her fiancé posed to the party's son. And then the court further ruled that the trial court should have permitted the parties to engage in cross-examination and to call lay and expert witnesses on their own behalf. Actually, I'm somewhat surprised that this was published in light of the very specific reasons. Very often what will happen in cases like that, they will not publish them. They'll be unpublished. So I'm going to have to read the entire decision with respect to why this case was considered important enough to have it published, because, for example, there was another case that was not approved for publication, DP versus ER, and again, that was appellate division, and this was back-to-back family court appeals concerned a child and posed the same question, whether the trial judge erred in declining to further entertain the two grandparent visitation claims because the custodial parent and the child had moved to Florida. So, you know, that was a case where they decided they weren't going to hear it, and they weren't going to remand it to the trial court. So I'm really pleased that my guest has arrived. you probably know him. Many of you know him because he's also my co-host on the sports program. His name is Bill Wolfson, and Bill has been practicing commercial law, bankruptcy, for how many years in Hunterdon now, Bill?
Well, almost 40.
Wow. Okay. So
that makes me older in a way.
Okay. Well, you haven't been practicing as long as I have, put it that way.
Okay.
Almost.
Well, but you probably got better at it faster.
I don't know about that, but I want to commend Bill because he just had a published article using bankruptcy and other strategies to protect the elderly and disabled. And I think that he wrote this. His co-author was Jane, Farron Zimmerman?
Farron Zimmer.
Zimmer.
Yeah, you may remember Jane is at Fleska Greenberg. She's a very, very skilled probate lawyer. And she spoke at our Hunterdon County Bar Association event for continuing legal education event on Election Day, and talk to us about the states and estate planning and being a fiduciary and things like that. And what I wanted to come and talk about today, after this article was published, because today was a publication date.
And again, tell the audience the name of the publication. Is it the Elderly Law Report?
No, it's the Elder Law Report, including Special Needs Planning. And this is published by Wolters Kluwer, it's a newsletter.
Okay.
It goes to many probate lawyers who handle estate cases, handle guardianship cases. Probate is basically a generalized term for handling the assets and the person or the property of somebody who is either deceased or unable to care for themselves. So it could be an elderly person, could be a person who's passed away. You have to administer the property that they've left behind. Or it could be somebody who's under the age of 18. And one of the problems that we have is that sometimes these are people who are easy to take advantage of, either because they're very young, or they're very old, or they're very ill, or they're no longer among the living. So we have a problem. Sometimes people who handle their assets, who we refer generally as fiduciaries, you could be an executor or a guardian, an administrator if there isn't a will, things like that, sometimes use the property of the person who they are responsible to care for or who they are responsible to distribute according to a will, or if there's no will, according to state law and what we call intestate succession. Sometimes they don't do it.
Well, in fact, that's interesting you say that. You know that I generally handle family law matters, but I'm handling guardianship right now, and very interesting, one of the siblings in this case who was handling the mother's money, she has now been ordered by the court to provide an accounting, and it's been very slow in coming. And, in fact, her idea or her attorney's idea of an accounting is just to turn over some checkbooks.
Well,
so, of course,
not always good enough.
Well, it isn't, of course, good enough, because you have to know, you know, where the income was coming in and if there were other accounts, how much was being transferred. And in this particular case, I think we're going to be able to show that, you know, she would put income into one account, she'd withdraw from the account, but wouldn't deposit 100% of that money in another account. Now, frankly, maybe she can justify how she used the hundreds of dollars of cash that she wouldn't deposit into the other checking account. And that's what an accounting is. I mean, nobody at this point is saying that this woman did anything wrong. We're just saying, hey, you have to show it. So let's get on, though, with your article, because I thought it was very interesting that that you're using bankruptcy and other strategies to protect the elderly.
Right.
So can you explain a little bit about, you know, what you concluded in your article?
Sure. I'm happy to, Pat. Thank you. Really what it boils down to is this. Sometimes people who are in charge of other people's assets do the wrong thing with them, or they can't account for what they did with them, or they make themselves a loan, and then they pay it back in whole or in part. And they're not really supposed to do that, or they don't spend the money in the way that they should. And sometimes they seek the protection of the bankruptcy courts.
Now, who would be seeking the protection of the bankruptcy court?
The person who's in charge of that money.
Who's in charge of that money and didn't use it properly.
Yeah, and it's because they want to get out from under the idea to pay it back, whether by way of judgment or by way of a lawsuit which results in a judgment. And one of the problems we have with bankruptcy is very, very short statutes of limitation to bring lawsuits to have debts declared non-dischargeable so that you can try to collect them and literally claw the money back. So if we have someone who has, let's say, a joint checking account with an elderly parent, a mom, let's say. And let's say hypothetically they're siblings. And let's say that mom is in her 80s, and although she's with it, she needs help paying bills and writing out checks. And so there's a joint checking account between mom and daughter.
Which is very, very often the case.
Very much so.
And so mom's income goes into, whether mom's living with the daughter or not, mom's income goes into the checking account. And the daughter, in your case, I think you're saying, is authorized to sign checks.
Right. Well, because it's a joint account, and the daughter is what we call an accommodation maker or co-signer on the checks. So if the daughter's paying for mom's doctor or mom's car insurance or mom's car payment or mom's medications or for mom to go to the hairdresser once a week or clothing or things like that, that is perfectly kosher, perfectly appropriate. What happens and where we see people getting into trouble is when they get a little greedy and they use some of the money because maybe they're short on their own home mortgage 1 month, or they decide that they are entitled to a vacation because they're taking care of mom and the other siblings mm-hmm. aren't. So they pull $5,000 or $8,000 out of mom's checking account and they go off and have a nice vacation somewhere.
Or they pay, and this is something I've seen, mom has a home and they have a home and they pay the utility bills, let's say for both homes, out of mom's account.
That's not what you're supposed to do.
Of course not.
There's a bright red line and they can get into trouble for crossing over it. So sometimes they get a little scared or they get a little worried or maybe their finances are not going well otherwise and they're in some financial trouble and they file a bankruptcy case. And maybe they name mom as a creditor or a sibling or maybe they don't. But even when that happens, we've got a very, very short window of opportunity to protect mom.
Well, what if, let's just take the scenario where they file bankruptcy. If they don't name mom as a creditor,
how would mom
ever find out?
Well, that's the answer. In that case, what I'm about to tell you doesn't apply until mom knows or has reason to know, or those other siblings know or have reason to know who might bring this claim.
Well, let me ask you, even before you get that, because this is something I think people might be interested in. Let's assume that the daughter and the mother have a joint account. And even if it's a legitimate bankruptcy on behalf that the daughter has to file, she's done nothing wrong. What does the bankruptcy court do with respect to that account because it's in the daughter's name with her mother, even though the daughter has never deposited any money in the account is opened in joint names just to accommodate because the daughter writes the checks. How does the bankruptcy court, how do you deal with that as an attorney?
Okay, well, first of all, in every bankruptcy petition, one of the questions that has to be answered by somebody who files bankruptcy is, are you holding any property that belongs to anybody else? And the answer to that question would then have to be, yes, I have $80,000 in a joint account, but that money belongs to my mom, and I haven't put a penny of my own money in there. I'm simply there to help her pay her bills with it because she is older, she likes my help, she trusts me, or perhaps she can no longer see to do so, or maybe she doesn't, on a good day she's fine, but a lot of her days are bad days, so she needs my help.
Okay, let's say that the client comes in and says this to you, and you're filling out the petition. What happens when the bankruptcy court gets that information?
Well, a bankruptcy trustee is going to sit down and read it. And the trustee is somebody appointed by the U.S. Trustee's Office to examine the petition and ask whoever files the bankruptcy questions about their finances. And it's the Chapter 7 trustee or Chapter 13 trustee is appointed by the U.S. trustee, and that's part of it's an arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. And the U.S. trustee's job is to make sure that people play the game honestly, fairly, and according to the law. So when a Chapter 7 trustee begins to look at the petition and schedules, and they see that there's $80,000 of mom's money being disclosed, not as an asset of the person who filed bankruptcy, the debtor, but as mom's asset, they're going to want some proof that this is all mom's money and not the person who filed bankruptcy, the daughter's money.
Okay, so in your case, when daughter comes in to see you, what kind of proof would you tell her that she needs to have?
I like to get 2 years' worth of bank statements, because what that's going to show is it's going to show that presumably these are pension and Social Security checks going in to the account. It may show that this is money from an IRA or 401k that the older person has been drawing on. So maybe there are transfers, say, from something like the American funds into the account. Every month there's a couple $1,000 to pay mom's bills. And that makes it pretty clear. Another thing that we do sometimes is we trace assets and we trace it back to the source of funds. So we try to get a couple years' worth of bank statements. We want to show where that money came from. Now, that money could have come from when, after dad died, mom sold the house and took the money and put it in the bank and made the daughter a co-signer on the account. The daughter is very careful and honest to only use that money for mom's purposes. The important thing here, though, is that a trustee is going to look at that, and as long as you can honestly show the source of the funds and that the daughter never really owned them, you're fine. There should not be a problem. On the other hand, there are times where people get powers of attorney so that they can sign mom's checks. Sometimes the funds are mixed in with the daughter's accounts, and then it becomes hard. Then we need to do a little digging, a little detective work or forensic work financially. Sometimes we have to hire an accountant to be able to look at this and say, because otherwise the trustee has a right to have that money turned over for the use of the daughter's creditors. So we try to be extremely careful in those circumstances. I hope I've answered your question.
Yes, you definitely had. So we're in a scenario now where, let's say that the daughter has inappropriately used. The first scenario, the first question dealt with how the daughter could make sure that her mother's money is not taken if she's filing bankruptcy. But what about the person who comes in to file bankruptcy and they have been inappropriately using money, whether they're the trustee, whether they're the guardian, whether they have power of attorney, or it's a joint account where you wouldn't need power of attorney? Is of a joint account, either party can sign checks, either party can put deposits in or take money out. So let's assume that in this case, mom was taking out money inappropriately.
Okay, well, let's say the daughter was taking out the money.
The daughter was taking out the money from mom's account inappropriately.
Well.
And paying her own expenses.
Well, then hopefully mom is able to go talk to a lawyer or talk to one of her other children about this problem, or a friend or family member, and is able to say, look, something has gone wrong here. My daughter has done this. I don't want to hurt her. But on the other hand, I want to be able to get this money back, because eventually she's employed, she'll have to pay it back or something. So what that requires is that within 60 days after the daughter is interviewed by the trustee, it's called the first meeting of creditors, which is usually about a month or two after the bankruptcy case is filed, what happens is that you must file something with the bankruptcy court called an adversary complaint. An adversary complaint is basically a lawsuit to have the judge declare that this debt is not entitled to be discharged because it's either been an embezzlement, a fraud, or what we call defalcation. Now, embezzlement means you had a right to possession of the funds, but you took them and used them for your own purposes. Fraud is where you lie, cheat, or steal to get those funds. Or there's something called larceny, which is a nice way to say steal, to get the money. And then we have that mystery word, defalcation.
Defalcation, and let me ask you, though, can you commit larceny if your name is on the account?
No, because you technically have a right to. You can commit an embezzlement, but...
How...
you can commit a defalcation.
Right, I know a defalcation, but how could you embezzle funds? Let's just say it's... Does it depend on whether or not you have a fiduciary duty, whether or not there is a power of attorney, for example? What if the parent just has set up an account in joint names with the adult child?
Well, then if an embezzlement implies that you had a right to possession of those funds and control of those funds...
Well, you would have control.
But you didn't use them for the purpose that you were supposed to.
Okay, but does there have to be anything in writing, or could this just be...
There should be, but... Sometimes people don't always live their lives the way we lawyers would like them to, or the way it makes it easy for us lawyers to help protect them or assert their rights.
But right now for our...
If it's not written, then it could be. You could still have a larceny, or you could still have... or theft, or you could still have an embezzlement, because sometimes... the trust relationship is implied in the actions. And one of the things bankruptcy judges look for, because a couple hundred years of law have told them to, is the idea that there has to be a special relationship of trust and a disparity in power, to where mom may not be comfortable confronting the daughter. She may not be aware of what's going on. She may not be able to see. She may not always have her wits about her. Or she may just be frightened that the daughter will throw her out and make her homeless. So you have a lot of those things going on. But to get back to your question about embezzlement, in an embezzlement there has to be some right that you've given as a mom to let your daughter control your money. And if the daughter doesn't use it for your purposes and uses it for her own purpose, say to buy herself a car so that she can take you to the hairdresser or shopping or to the doctor and kind of put a little bit of lipstick on the pig, so to speak, we have... essentially an embezzlement, and that may result in a non-dischargeable debt, because again, what judges look at is the disparity in power, the disparity of control, and the ability, and whether there's an entrustment. Then we get to that word that nobody knew the meaning of until the U.S. Supreme Court explained it to us, and that was, that's the word defalcation. For years, for 150 or 200 years, lawyers argued and judges disagreed in opinions over what defalcation really meant. In a case called Bullock versus Champaign Bank, what happened was that there was a guy by the name of Bullock who was a younger man, and when his parents died, there was a family trust set up, the trust had been set up previously. Mr. Bullock was running the family mill, whether it was a sawmill or a sugar mill, I don't know, but it was in Illinois, and who knows what they do in Illinois. We can talk about the Chicago Bears later. But what Mr. Bullock did was he decided he needed to borrow some money, and being the trustee, he borrowed the money to put in the family business. And he had an absolute right to go to the bank and pull the money out. But what he didn't have a right to do was to use the money to put into the family business when he was one of the owners of the business, he was one of the people in control of the business, but trust did not exist for that purpose. And he was already the trustee before he committed this bad act. Well, putting the money into the business didn't really help all that much, and the business went south, and eventually he was able to pay some but not all of the money back. So the bank that was the corporate fiduciary, one of the trustees, brought a lawsuit against him in the bankruptcy court saying, hey, you still owe this money because you did something wrong. You took this money and you did not use it for the purposes of the trust. Now, even though you paid some of it back, that was a pretty reckless act. What the Supreme Court did, and I think it was Justice Kagan, wrote an opinion that said you don't have to have a bad or evil intent to do something wrong. It's enough if you are reckless or reckless about what you do with those funds, and you knew or had reason to know that you had no right to use this money for this purpose, where you took this money without regard to whether there was a risk that you might lose this money in some way, shape, or form. So one of the things that Justice Kagan decided to do, and I think she was wise, she imposed what's called a recklessness standard, borrowing from our criminal laws. And we have criminal laws in every state, and we have, as you know, Pat, very scholarly legal works written by lawyers and judges who like to write for the American Law Institute. And there is a restatement of law on the criminal laws, and it talks about recklessness. And recklessness is basically an intentional disregard for the risk that harm is going to happen. It is like getting in your car at 3 o'clock when the kids are leaving the school and crossing the street, closing your eyes and stepping on the gas pedal. That's a reckless act. You may not intend to hurt anybody, but it's very likely that because of your conduct, someone's going to get run over. Well, Justice Kagan imposes this standard now on people who are in charge of other people's money and says, if you're going to be reckless with somebody else's money, don't expect the debt to be discharged in a bankruptcy case.
Okay, so let's assume that, I'm assuming in this case, for example, if the daughter decided to invest in very risky stock, mm-hmm. That would be considered reckless.
Oh, yes.
So
very
that,
much so.
But then get back to the practical point. Daughter has come in to file bankruptcy. You know, she spent this money. She should not have spent the money. So if the bankruptcy caused that money back, how do they deal with it? And how do they deal with other credits in relation to this? Is there, if somebody has embezzled, does that mean that the person they've embezzled from has a preference in bankruptcy repayment? I mean, is mom ever going to get repaid, I guess is the bottom line question.
Here's why it becomes important, and it's important for two reasons. First of all, even if the other debts get canceled or discharged in bankruptcy, now that person is otherwise debt-free, and it's easier and more likely that the injured party the victim would be able to collect their money.
So, but let's say...
And they can, and let me finish, they can sue them in state court or enforce their judgment in state court and get a wage garnishment or grab earnings or grab a house or grab a car or something like that, or force them to find a way to pay.
Well, I understand that, but what if I'm kind of in relation... Let's assume there is a pot of money and there are a number of creditors. They're not going to get paid dollar for dollar, but they're going to get paid something
out of that pot of money.
Is mom with that group, or is there some preference that she gets paid back first because of the embezzlement?
Well,
I'm talking about from the pot of money.
Well, Pat, that's an excellent question. And the terrible answer that lawyers always have to give is what I call the definite maybe. It depends. But what does it depend on? And what's the source of that pot of money? If some of the source of that pot of money was mom's money or mom's stock.
No, let's say it, let's just say it was daughter's, you know, daughter had assets that she has to liquidate to pay the creditors. So there is a pot of money to let's say them, and I know it's usually not the case, but let's say that the creditors with that pot of money, if you weren't thinking about mom, might get, you know, 20 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar, which is not unusual.
Well, mom would have the right to get her fair share of that money along with the other creditors.
But does she have a preference to get paid back first before the other creditors whack up the money?
The answer to that is because that right isn't embedded in Section 507 or 502 of the Bankruptcy Code, the answer to that is no. Where we have a problem is that once that money is distributed and mom gets her fair share, her advantage over the other creditors, if she does things correctly, files a necessary lawsuit, is that she now has the right to continue collection action once the bankruptcy case is over.
And she can get a judgment against the daughter.
Right.
Where everything else is discharged.
Yeah.
So that the record would still show that mom, in this case, has a right to a judgment.
That's right. And she's got a right to enforce it.
But there's no preference.
No.
Even if some of the creditors, you know, perhaps it was a very foolish loan that a creditor made to daughter, and even though this was basically criminal, she embezzled from a bankruptcy standpoint, that person's not going to get a preference.
That's exactly the case. She doesn't get the proverbial leg up over the fence to try to collect some more money. What she does get is the chance to continue after the bankruptcy case is over. One of the problems, though, is that after the chicken's been plucked, there may not be any feathers.
Exactly.
But if the debt doesn't go away, sooner or later the chicken's going to grow more feathers.
Well, you hope. So, in other words, would after the bankruptcy, would she still have like a 20-year time to collect on that judgment? Would it be a judgment, or would she have to go to state court then to get the judgment?
She would then have to go back to state court to enforce her judgment. And we have many means of doing that. We already know what the daughter's assets were because she filed it in a bankruptcy petition and presumably she told the truth. But we've seen some pretty strange things happen. We had a situation where we had to collect from some people who had lied, cheated, and stolen to get a loan, and lied about it, and falsified financial statements, and we sued them in bankruptcy court, and the judge agreed with us that the debt should not be discharged. And lo and behold, about 8 months later, the bad guys win the New Jersey lottery. So there's the ultimate good news. Bad news joke. The good news is you've won the lottery. The bad news is that Bill Wolfson has the Mercer County Sheriff ready to grab the money. And to finish the story, at the time, I was helping the Resolution Trust Corporation clean up an old savings and loan who had made this bad loan. And I had to deal with a very, very tough, stern government lawyer in Philadelphia. And I knew she was real no-nonsense, so I tried never to joke around with her. Because my personality is, this is tough work. Let's keep
the tone a little light,
but let's do our job and do it quickly. So I had the, I saw this, and I happened to see it by opening up a newspaper. And when I did that, after I had my non-dischargeability judgment, and I still had my writ of execution out because the bankruptcy was a 7 and it was over very quickly. What happened was I sent the writ to the Mercer County Sheriff. I asked them to go to the lottery commission, and when they handed this woman the big check, he handed her the writ of execution, and he handed it to the fellow at the New Jersey Lottery Commission. So I had to call up this very stern career government lawyer and say, I have the ultimate good news, bad news joke for you. And she said, I don't want jokes. I said, well, here's the story. The good news is that so-and-so has won the New Jersey lottery. And the bad news is that I had the Mercer County Sheriff levy on the $1 million that she won this morning. And she put her head back and laughed, and she said, I'm going to call Washington, and I want you to tell them this. And so she puts me on the phone, and I tell her boss, who was somebody in an office in the U.S. Treasury or some agency in D.C., and the guy puts his head back and laughs and laughs and laughs, and then he says, when are we going to get the money? And I said, well, I'm going to have to do what's called a motion for turnover, and that's going to take about 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm sure someone's going to try to fight me on it. So I'm going to tell you 6 weeks. So, and in a month, we had gotten an order from a judge.
Okay. Well, let's play a couple spots, and then I think we're with the, at the end of the program. This has really been very interesting, and I think that people do need to be careful. You know, it's to me, it's horrendous to take advantage of somebody elderly, and especially if it's a family member. But we won't go there because we all see the bad stuff. So we'll be back with the sports guys.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
As a partial government shutdown over the issue continues, President Trump is now looking again for bipartisan support when it comes to border security. The White House inviting top leaders from both parties to a brief